Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks for joining us. I just spoke with Maki Fukuoka about her new book, The Premise of Fidelity, Science, Visuality, and Representing the Real in 19th Century Japan. This was published with Stanford University Press in 2012. This is a book that very effectively transcends disciplinary boundaries by creating a study about visuality, forms of knowing, and evidence in a context of 19th century Japan that transcends fields of history of science, history of medicine, history of Japan, art history, history of botany, by incorporating elements that are of interest to all of them into a story that can very easily be accessed and be treated as something that's a very informationally but also conceptually meaningful by scholars working in any of these fields. So it's a study that focuses on practices of observation and practices of reconciling different forms of evidence and the knowledge of objects, especially of materia medica, by a group in 19th century Japan who are working on forms of knowledge that are important to their practice as doctors and that later become important to some of them in their practice as bureaucrats for the state. It's a really interesting consideration of the ways that if we move away from understanding contexts like this in terms of dichotomies of East and West, dichotomies of science and non-science, of text and image, and toward a way of thinking about how modes of understanding for these people in 19th century Japan, but also perhaps more broadly, involve a process of movement among different kinds of media without necessarily feeling like they or we have to choose among them or prioritize among them necessarily, depending on context, how thinking about the history of science, the history of visuality, the history of images, and history more generally might actually change, how it might change the terms of the conversation. So it's a study that is really interesting and useful if you're interested in images, in objects, if you're interested in plants, in medicine, or in Japan, or any of the above, or none of the above. And it was a real pleasure to talk with Maki about this project and to hear a little bit also toward the end about what she's working on next and how these interests that are developed in the book are going to continue to be developed in later projects. So I hope you enjoy, and here is the interview. We're here today to talk with Maki Fukuoka about her book, The Premise of Fidelity, Science, Visuality, and Representing the Real in 19th Century Japan. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Maki, and thank you so much for making the time to talk with me today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Of course. So, Maki, could you start us off by saying a little bit about your background? What brought you to the field of art history and its engagement with modern Japan?
I started out studying photography as an art practice in undergraduate, and I realized very quickly that I wasn't very good at it. Taking photographs and developing photographic images. But I wanted to find a way to stay very close to it. So history of photography was one way in which I figured I can still look at the images and talk about them. And so that was at the end of my bachelor's degree. And for master's degree, I was studying American history of photography. And so I wasn't particularly trained as a Japanese historian up until then, but it was also at a time when I took some courses in my graduate school about Japan, and there seems to be an intersection between history of photography and what I was studying in was, you know, intellectual history of modern Japan, and that's really where the book originated.
So the book that we're talking about today looks at changing modes of visuality, changing modes of understanding visuality, and the evidence of knowledge of the natural world in Tokugawa Japan and Meiji Japan. It focuses on the 19th century. So how did you come to focus on this particular period and this particular set of texts and people? So what brought you to this as a dissertation topic?
So after I took some courses on modern Japan during my graduate course, I started looking or reading a lot of books about Japanese history of photography. And then it all started in the same place. In 1858, somebody got a camera. And I knew that's probably a fact, but I also felt that was a very easy, clean entry of technology. So I started digging a little bit earlier, not in terms of technological importation, but as a concept. And so I wrote a dissertation proposal, which was about rewriting that beginning of Japanese history of photography. And as I went to do my dissertation research in Japan, I came across this bunch of groups of herbalists that were making really amazing images with inks, but also with photography. And prior to that, as I talked in the introduction, there was a trip to Leiden where I was trying to look at this particular zograscopic lens that was brought from Japan to Leiden and encountered this manuscript, which really didn't fit into the narrative history of photography of Japan that I was accustomed to. So those two things were the triggers, I think, of this book.
I love that word too, zograscope. That was one of my favorite words of the book.
Yes, in zograscope.
Zograscope. I just love that. So can you talk a little bit about how you transformed the project from a dissertation into a book? Were there any notable moments along the way or anything about the process that involved either significant revision, significant transformation in the way you were thinking about the issues and the arguments that you were making? And or was there anything notable about the narrative that you adopted in the book versus the dissertation? Any aspect of that process you want to share with me?
Okay.
We'd love to hear.
Well, so the dissertation was really written for my committee, and I think that's true to anybody. And they were consisted of two art historians, one Japanese historian. And when I was revising it as a book, I realized some of the discussions in the dissertation was so narrowly argued, but it doesn't have any relevance to anyone outside of history of photography or history of art, per se. And so there was a lot of rethinking about the audience, and I'm still not sure if I reached the audience that I wanted to reach, but there was an adjustment. Okay, so who am I speaking to? And in that process, I chunked three chapters, I think, from my dissertation, and rewrote two new chapters and also reorganized a lot of materials within. So the shift focus from talking specifically about visuality as, you know, theorized by certain Western philosophers, etc., to really focusing on historical context in which these materials were embedded.
So what, if you don't mind me asking, because this is actually, it's a really interesting set of issues, what audience did you specifically want the book to reach, and what chapters did you add as a result of that?
Yeah, so the audience I wanted to reach were beyond a historians of photography. That I knew. And I also wanted to reach audiences in history as a field, or intellectual history as well. And those would be Japan specialists. And I also figured there has to be a conversation that this book can offer between science, technology, and art. And those are the three kind of broad categories of audiences that I imagined. And so the chapters that went out as a result of this were chapters that talked specifically about outlines. So it is in a book, you know, if you start looking at the pictures alone, you see some of the images have really bold outlines and the ink drivings, you know, wouldn't. And so there's a chapter about outlines in my dissertation. And I figured I can find a way to footnote it. Not that it's less important, but it's really hard to test the patience of the audience, for instance, who are interested in science and technology by my elongated, you know, argument about outlines. So I struggled with it, actually. The chapters that I wrote for this book were the first two chapters that really sets this group within the historical network of people that existed in Japan, and, you know, talked about what medical doctor, what it meant to be a doctor, in this period.
That's so interesting, because I think one of the, you know, coming at this as a reader and as a reader trained in the history of science, as well as Chinese history, I read this as very much, very comfortably and wonderfully situated within a discourse of history of science literature too. So this is to say that whatever you did to refashion this into the kind of book that would be a very coherent object that would appeal to multiple different communities, including communities of the history of science and medicine, well done. I think it really succeeds in doing that. In fact, I think this is, in some ways, and we can talk about this later if you want, or I can just, I'll just mention this for listeners who might be interested. This forms part of what we might consider to be a kind of community or a dialogue about visuality, observation, images, and the history of science within the field of the history of science and the history of medicine. So I think it manages at the same time to both contribute meaningfully and feel very, or be situated very comfortably in Japanese history, but also in the history of science.
So that's really great. I'm grateful for your comments.
Oh, no, this is one of the things I think, you know, I'm kind of biased in my excitement about finding books that have one foot in the history of science and medicine and one foot in the history of Asia and East Asia specifically. So, you know, so I was thrilled. So let's get into the body of the book itself. Let's really kind of get into the arguments and get into the narrative. We've talked a little bit about already the nature of the kinds of broad phenomena that you're talking about, and you just mentioned tangentially in your explaining of the way the book actually differs from what the dissertation was doing. You mentioned a group. So much of the book is going to look at the work of this group, and this is a group called the Shōhyakusha. Yeah. Am I getting that sort of right?
Yeah.
So this is a small community of scholars based in the castle town of Nagoya, in the Owari domain, who were interested in the study of materia medica. And I mention for listeners, and also just to bring this up at the very early part of the conversation, I'm mentioning that they were in the Owari domain because later on in the book, what's going to become apparent is the locality that the work of the members of this group is, or the locality of in which the work is happening is actually going to become really important to the nature of ideas about visuality and ways of representing the real that these group members are producing. And so the fact that this is in Owari at the beginning is actually going to turn out to be really important in different ways. So can you start us off then by talking a little bit about this group? What was the nature of this group, and what do we need to know in order to understand what happens later on in the book as you explore the work of this group and the ideas of this group?
Right. So the group, we still don't have a definitive list of who was in it. Their occasional listing of, you know, who came to the meeting, etc. But mostly physicians who are trained either Western medicine, Chinese medicine. There are two schools of Chinese medicines, but all health concerned citizens. And there are a few exceptional cases of gardeners or a pharmacologist. Those are exceptional. So majority of the group, probably anywhere between 20 to 25 during their active periods in the group itself. And they were all living in Hawaii, but they also had studied medicine in different cities prior to becoming a doctor. So they would continue to have dialogues with their doctors in different domains throughout the activities. And their concern was mostly that they wanted to be so certain of the herbs that are given to the patients to cure their illness. And there was a problem with Arteria Medica and being able to identify if this plant is actually the variation of the Chinese source or if it's a completely different one.
Great. And this is a concern that you refer to at various points in the book and certainly in this opening section of the book as the relationship of fidelity, the language of fidelity, among the different forms of evidence that they're bringing together to both learn about Materia Medica, to secure a sense of sort of reliable knowledge on which they can base their medical practice, and also to differentiate among kinds of Materia Medica that might be confused with one another. And so this idea of fidelity becomes really important, and the book is going to go on to look at the way members of this group negotiated among textual knowledge, illustrations, and the plants, or in some cases the physical objects, the material objects themselves that were extant to Japan. And you make you kind of serially develop an argument in the book about the ways that these different forms of knowledge across this period that you're looking at in different ways, but all, you know, it's all related, mutually reinforce one another. So it's not one or the other. We're going to see knowledge making that emerges out of relationships among what we might consider to be otherwise very different forms of knowledge making. Mm-hmm. Now, this opens up actually a key theme in the book, and that is the changing meanings of the term shashin. This is a term that's used to mean photography in contemporary Japanese, but you show that it actually emerges from a very different kind of context. And so can you talk a little bit about this term? How did you settle on the term shashin as being one of the focal objects that you use to trace a history for this book? And how did this emerge to be so important for you? And how are you revising along the way other scholars or other people think about the connection between shashin and photography?
So I spoke a little bit earlier about how I started reading history of Japanese photography in my graduate work, and there was this very clear beginning for everyone, every historian, and it was this year, and it was this importation of camera. But the funny thing about history of photography in Japan, and I knew this back then, is that this term, shashin, that we use for photography, pre-existed the arrival of photography. And it has a long semantic history that is borrowed from Chinese aesthetic discourse. So coming from this background where I studied mostly European and American history of photography, this was a very new thing. This was seemed like a very interesting point of departure, where in Europe, in America, the word photography was concocted for this particularly new and interesting thing. So in Japan, you know, it's a little bit different conceptually. So that was always in the back of my mind, that this term is something to investigate. But when I saw this set up manuscript in Leiden, where the term was used as a title, without meaning that it means photography, without referring to photographic media, I thought, okay, this is a concrete example that I can recover my long questioning and perhaps start answering it. So it's the other aspect of it too is that when historians of photography write about photography in Japanese, they take this term shashin, and because this is, you know, second part shin, which can be translated as truth or real, they use that to explain what photography is, right? So because the term already has truth or real in it, photography is always inherently truthful and realistic. And I was troubled by that. I didn't know how I could resolve that, but I thought that has to be unpacked a little bit more. And then this project came along.
Great. Thank you so much. And so one of the things that happens in the book is that in the service of unpacking that term and unpacking the different ways that that term becomes put into dialogue with notions of the real in different contexts, the chapters are going to successively and unsuccessively, if I may say so myself, each look at different settings in which the members of this group are reconciling notions of fidelity and visuality by putting into dialogue these relationship between the real and the transposition of the real or shashin. In their work as physicians in chapter 1, in translations of texts from China and Europe in chapter 2, in organized public exhibitions in chapter 3, in the production of pictorial representations in different media, some of which are actually really fascinating in chapter 4, and finally in the last chapter of the book, in governmental institutions in which they were employed. And we'll see how issues of the state and the nation come into the dialogue in a new way in this last chapter of the book. So let's start out at the first chapter.
Yeah.
You just mentioned, and you've talked a little bit already about this manuscript in Leiden that changed the way you thought about shashin and that changed the way you thought about its relationship to photography. This is a work called the Honzo Shashin that was produced in 1826, and you talk about this both in the introduction and the first chapter. So can you introduce for listeners a little bit, what was this manuscript, what was in it, and why, in what way was it really important to understanding what was happening with shashin in this period?
Yeah, so it's a set of a manuscript is a set of 15 prints, and there is no coherent media. Some are hand-drawn and some are ink rubbings, and the set itself is called Honzo Shashin, and it was brought to Leiden by Siebold, who was a physician in Japan around that time. So as I did some archival research, it came very clear to me this manuscript was an evidence of a particular meeting between this group and Siebold. So it's part of a conversation that really got this group started thinking more about representation, and also a way to ask Siebold for confirmation of their own knowledge. A particular plant is depicted, is this, you know, what is the linear name for this particular plant, etc. So it's a portfolio of different, 15 different prints made with different techniques, grouped together under the title of Honzo Shashin, Shashin again meaning photography in contemporary Japan, but must have meant something else then. And it really became our a puzzling piece because, as I say, in the chapter 1 in the introduction, the ways that these images are made are still mysterious to me, some of them. So it seems to be a copy, but exactly how it was copied from which original is still uncertain. So it's a great book of manuscript of mystery.
And you actually, there's some wonderful descriptions of and images of the recto, mm-hmm. surface of some of these images in the book, in which you actually can see outlines, just to invoke one of the things that you were talking about earlier, outlines of the perhaps the actual specimens from which these images are made.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I guess what is interesting about this portfolio, in addition to this, you know, different media, is that it was made by this group to bring to this meeting with Siebold. In other words, it's something that they produce so that they can ascertain better information. Oftentimes this group, very local group, a small group, when they were written in history of Japan, they are understood to be a mediator, that they took something from the West and introduced to the Japanese community. But what this manuscript shows is that, no, it's not actually this passive relationship that they were acting accordingly. They were actually active. They were proactive and asking questions to Siebold, and they were producing images. And that was another aspect of this group that really attracted me, is that they were local. They seem unimportant in historiography of Japanese science so far, but what they did had a significant ripple effect, especially when it came to Meiji. And the other thing that I want to mention is that in history of Japan, 19th century, oftentimes scholarly works are done on either Edo, which was the capital, or Kyoto, which was where the emperor resided. And there's not much else. It gives an impression. There's not much else going on in English history of Japan about 19th century in English. And I thought, well, maybe that needs to be modified a little bit. And Owari, as a location between those two cities, was a very attractive element as well.
Chapter 1 actually does a really nice job of situating the kind of work that's being done in the Honzo Shashin within this global context of medical ideas, medical knowledge, and medical practice in Owari. And one of the things that you mentioned as being particularly notable about that practice is that although we tend to think about the history of medicine in Japan, and I would also say this is also true for historiography of medicine in China, as an issue of dichotomies, right? So Japan versus the West, one versus the other. What's actually happening is that practicing physicians, and certainly members of this group who are producing knowledge and trying to reconcile knowledge about materia medica, again, for the purpose of their practice, are negotiating among very different forms of sort of what we might consider to be local or medical tradition. I use the word tradition in sort of scary, hairy scare quotes right now. But there's you mentioned here, and I think demonstrate really effectively, that they were aware of the existence of a diversity of approaches to understanding the natural world, and they kind of moved between them in the course of their practice. So there's the latter day ideas that are coming from older texts in Japan. There's the, quote, old way of medical knowledge that's coming from Chinese texts. And then there's Western, what we might consider Western medical knowledge. And they coexist in this locality of Owari, and they coexist for the practitioners in a really interesting way that I think really helps us undo these dichotomies of historical medicine.
Yeah, I mean, that's something was very surprising to me as well, that they do know that these modes of knowledge exist, and they have their, they have their own limits. And oftentimes what happened in Edo or Kyoto was this kind of quarrel, which method is more superior than the other, etc. But in this particular group, I think their main concern was curing their patients. So as long as something worked, it wasn't an alliance with a particular school of medicine that they were interested in. They were really interested in finding a cure. And it makes it very clear that this kind of dichotomy that's, prevalent, East-West or old Chinese or, Dutch, all these things are very much a construct that really didn't matter to these people as much.
So one of the really interesting things that happens in this part of the book is that you're showing how experimental human dissections in the late 18th century are actually transforming the field of medical study by incorporating access to an actual or real, a physical human body as a source of medical knowledge. So can you talk a little bit about that and how the role that that's playing in the development of this knowledge of this period?
Yeah, so dissection of human body was very much controlled by the government back then. And medical practitioners relied upon books to understand anatomy up until then. Around the late 18th century, there are several people who started to doubt what they understood in text and figured, okay, what's the best way to verify my knowledge? And that was to actually see the body. And so some, the first one, Yamama Kitoyo, would experiment with water. because his master tells him, since, you know, you can't, you have to break a law to do human dissection, why don't you try with otter? And he goes and finds an otter. And his problem isn't, he can't resolve his question. So Yamawaki is one example, but there are few practitioners then who wanted to really see the actual body to be able to verify and also resolve the anatomical questions that they had in mind. There's this kind of shift from reliance on text to reliance on actual thing. And then very much the Soihakusha's practice is an extension of that logic, that we should really be able to verify that through our perceptual faculty before we take anything that's written in text for granted.
So speaking of things that are written in text, one of the really wonderful things that you show in the next chapter is the way that text functioned, not in contradistinction to an image, but that also functioned as a kind of visual medium.
Yeah.
Chapter 2 looks at the translation of works on Materia Medica. And one of the issues that comes up here before we get into the one of the really interesting texts that you talk about is the larger context that this is understood in, and that is the preoccupation of members of this group with names and with naming. So can you start us off in our discussion of this section of the book by talking a little bit about the importance of names and naming? Why is naming so important to these physicians and thinkers?
Yeah. So the texts that they were studying, either in imported through the Dutch or from China, were written in foreign languages. And what they were interested, this group of people were interested in, so in other words, this text in Latin or in Chinese would express the names of plants in their own languages. So there's a question, okay, we see a plant that seems to be seems to have a beneficial effect, for instance, for eye disease related to eye, but they couldn't figure out, well, there are multiple candidates for that within their own geographical location. So the plant represented in Dutch text, for instance, could be identified as X, Y, and Z in their own environment, both visually and through language. And on top of that, in Japan at that time, there are so many regional names given to plants. So a village X might call the same plant in a different name. This complete disarray of names and plants that were happening. And one of the jobs that this group set out to do was to untangle these complicated relationships and make it much linear and, you know, slimmer, the relationship between names and plants.
So the chapter focuses on the work of a leading member of this group, Ito Keisuke, and his publication of a work that we can translate as Nominal Differentiations in Western Materia Medica. Now that sounds like a kind of long, elaborate title for what winds up being a really fascinating, visually and conceptually, a really, really fascinating text. So This turns out to be the first published attempt to apply Linnaean botanical nomenclature to Japanese flora. So this is, you know, a moment where historians of science who are interested in classification and medicine and biology will perk up their ears, I hope. So Linnaean taxonomy becomes really important to this text. And the visuality of the script itself also plays an important role in Keisuke's publication. So would you talk a little bit about that, like how the text itself becomes a kind of image, and what does that have to do with this use of and prioritization of Linnaean taxonomy?
Yeah, that's probably best read in the chapter. It's very, so one of the one of the advantages of using Linnaean names, according to this group, was that it's based on the principle. The names are based on the principle, Linnaean names. And that's something that was lacking in the names in Chinese or Japanese or their regional names. So if you see a character for plant X, that character had no relationship to the plant itself, whereas the Linnaean name had a relationship to the thing. So that name, the construction of the Linnaean name itself, became very attractive or very alluring, because once you understand the principal organizing structure of the Linnaean system, anybody could speak with exact same name to each other so they can communicate and not get confused about regional names and Chinese name, etc. The visuality aspect of the alphabets, Roman alphabet, is another, I think, my impression is that it became a way to make a shortcut so that we can, anybody who understands Linnaean names can come to an agreement much faster than having to go through transliteration or, phonetic adaptation of, into Chinese character, etc. So the alphabet became a visual code in a way that Chinese or Japanese writings couldn't offer.
And it's actually, it's a really interesting part. I'm sorry, did I cut you off? Do you want to?
No, I'm not here for making.
Oh, you totally are. I think one of the really interesting things about this is that people might have seen, or listeners or readers of the book might have seen images that look like this before, right? You have a page of text with Chinese characters, with Japanese alphabetic characters, and with Roman letters spelling out a name. And, what you might think, well, that's really interesting. I wonder why that would be. Why would an author preserve the typography like that, or preserve the shape of the local letters like that? Well, what comes out of that? And, this chapter presents an explanation for that. And so it's a really, I think, interesting way to, and I also, I'll direct listeners to the book itself, because the chapter does a really wonderful way of really going into the intricacies of the kinds of decisions, the kinds of epistemic bases on which an author would have decided to preserve the visual elements of all of these scripts on the same page, in a way that's, I think, possibly translatable from this particular text in this particular context you're talking about into other ways of thinking about multi-scriptural manuscripts and publications that are coming out of very different contexts. What I'm not saying is that the arguments here, unproblematically would translate to other contexts, because you're very, very careful to locate this very specifically. But it does give us, because the arguments that you're making are based on arguments from understanding how epistemic principles function locally, that way of being sensitive to the epistemic principles that function locally in thinking about how to explain other cases of multi-scriptural publication, I think is very useful. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. And I think that the fact that this was a group was so important in decisions like that, that they weren't interested in some kind of individual accumulation of knowledge. They really wanted to share this. And that there was this, patients who were coming to them who needed to be cured. So the communication was the primary concern for them, and the fact that they used, it's not a simple translation from Latin to Japanese, or the steps of very careful strategic decisions that were made so that this book, Taisei Honzo Meisho, could be used as this device to communicate to much larger audiences.
So speaking of much larger audiences, that actually brings us really nicely to the next chapter. Chapter 3 looks at the practice of collective public exhibition as a way, or honzokai, as a way to generate knowledge of materia medica. So here, this is a totally fascinating chapter. These seem like really fascinating events. And at the beginning of the chapter, you walk us through the setting and the experience of a representative, or what might have been a representative collective exhibition, by mapping out the space as represented in a woodblock print from 1844. And so just that mode of reading an image in that way is really interesting. But for listeners who might not be familiar with this kind of event, with this kind of exhibition, can you talk a little bit about what one might find there? So what kinds of objects are included? What kind of event was this? And what kinds of people would you see at this kind of event?
So these are organized. The print that I reproduced in the book is of an exhibition that was organized by the official medical school. But the function of it, it's a public exhibit, is function is to bring in people so they can actually see the things, both exotic or indigenous, and verify the names. Again, I think the name was a very important aspect of it. The official, the print itself, in occasions like that, I think there were elements of novelty, that weird new things were exhibited as well, sort of like a, you know, precursor or something similar to World Exposition, but, you know, much, much smaller scale. And the organizing scheme of exhibitions like that relied very much on Chinese epistemology, that's, you know, from Materia Medica. So minerals, plants, skeleton, animals, and, you know, I don't know, two-headed snakes, etc. Yeah, and the people, you know, medical doctors, but also samurais, and in the print itself, we see one woman with a child and several Buddhist monks. So I think that occasions like that were very much looked forward to going to exhibition.
So the chapter looks very carefully. It takes us into the setting, and it looks really carefully at how members of this group that we're talking about negotiated or triangulated, to use a term that comes up a lot in the book, among different kinds of evidence in trying to reconcile knowledge about materia medica, which was one kind of object among, you know, the skeletons and the animal carcasses and all these other kinds of things that were focused on in these exhibitions. So they were triangulating between or among what they saw, what they knew previously, and what they could learn anew from the materiality of the object itself, and also from other people at the site. And so can you talk a little bit about this process of negotiation? Sort of how did incorporating, how were they thinking about the importance of incorporating the evidence from the physicality or materiality of the object itself, and also evidence from other people who might have been just kind of wandering in, who might know something about some of these objects?
Yeah, there are a few examples from the period that called for items for the exhibition that I analyzed in the book. And they seem to be, the organizers oftentimes interested in people bringing in their own stuff. So if you had a question about, you know, what tree is this, or what is this flower that's different from the flower I've seen before, then people will bring it to the exhibition, and they can have a conversation. It will be exhibited. Someone would put a name tag to it, but there was always a discussion about whether or not that attributed name was right.
Can I just, it makes me think of a kind of 19th century version of Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah,
sorry, go on.
There was no, like, yeah, exactly like that, except for the monetary value.
Right. So epistemic value or curative value, right, would replace monetary value.
Exactly, yeah. And it was a very short, all the exhibitions were usually ended in a day or 3 days at the most. So I there was an element to this particular chapter that I didn't really get to go into when I was revising it, but I think it's very much part of what was happening, is that there was during this period, there was enormous appreciation of looking at or visually satisfying one's desire by looking at weird stuff. There are a few articles written in English about it, but it's this practice of, for instance, you know, figures of samurais that are made of chrysanthemum flowers or furnitures that are made to look like a mythological figure. Seals that are taken from the ocean that, you know, one doesn't get to see often. So it's this, it's a popular culture that really appreciated seeing things that are not familiar. And I think in a sense, the medical, the exhibitions that I talk about in this book are specifically for medically, organized by medically related issues, but it can also be contextualized within this much broader popular culture where seeing became sort of like a, I don't know, a fun thing to do to spare one's time.
And it's also related in a way, interestingly, to what you're doing in the book in another part of this chapter, which is you can think about the larger phenomenon within which you're contextualizing this specific sort of set of observations of materia medica, you know, within this larger context of fascinations with the strange or the unusual. With you can put that into dialogue, basically, with the point that you're making in this chapter that heterogeneity, which is a form of talking about the unfamiliar, right?
Yeah.
Heterogeneity and the embracing of an expectation of heterogeneity among different kinds of sources of evidence was actually crucial to observational practices by the members of this group in this period. And so that seems related, actually, to this larger phenomenon and this larger context of the unfamiliar and the strange.
Right. I think they were never surprised to find something that they didn't know. In other words, they never concluded, right? We know everything.
Surprise itself was unsurprising.
Yeah, exactly. So always on the verge of, you know, being surprised or waiting to be surprised even. And yeah.
That's great. And I just, that there's so, that chapter itself also just opens up the promise of so many directions that that you can go with this material. And so it's a really, really rich chapter. It's very focused and it's very carefully argued, but there are, I imagine many possible readers reading that chapter and being very inspired to take it in lots of different directions. And I think that's one of the wonderful things about the book.
I feel like there are a lot in the footnotes.
Yes.
That I didn't really, you know, put in the argument itself, but, footnotes are where the treasures are.
Well, that's actually a really useful thing to direct listeners and readers to, right? Because that's not always the case. In a paper, that's definitely the case. So this actually brings us to the next chapter, which is a chapter that looks really closely at two particular techniques of visual representation that are used by the members of this group we're talking about, copper etching and ink rubbing prints. Now, this is we've talked a little bit about ink rubbings as one of the media that's used in this manuscript that you said, you know, from which your interest in this project originally emerged when you saw it in Leiden. But this is a particularly interesting visual medium for all kinds of reasons, certainly in the context of understanding what the product, what this particular kind of product of engagement, visual engagement, means and meant to members of this group. So with that in mind, can you talk a little bit about this technique? What was ink rubbing and what kind of image did it produce, and what epistemic role in terms of understanding the real, understanding observation, et cetera, did this particular medium play for the members of this group?
Right. Ink rubbing, as far as I could tell, probably originated way back. But the way in which this particular group used was specifically for plants. So they would take a specimen. They go to excursions in the mountains, always looking for the new and the strange or whatever they haven't seen before. And they'll take a plant and they would apply it directly to the plant itself, oftentimes. Or they'll take a plant and apply the ink indirectly by using this temple method that I talk about a little bit in the chapter. So what happens is one has either the mirroring image of the plant or the direct transference of the shadow of the plant itself, that the shadow meaning the ink part. And this, there are historians who argue that this came from a practice of taking rubbings from stone scriptures that originated in China and somehow got made to the people that are applying to plants. Now, that has a very long history, and what I find interesting is that this is the only group that use this method to make images of plants. In other words, people knew of this ink rubbing of stone scriptures for long, many centuries, but nobody really thought to apply it to plants other than this group. So that, to me, is a very interesting point. And then there's another example. I think, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, but there's a guy named Kuhnhoff who started making prints in Holland, where he would take dried specimen of a plant and press it under the press machine and get an impression of a plant and use that as sort of like a shadow image. And oftentimes he would color it. There's beautiful examples that precedes, you know, this particular Shohyakshen group. And they did also have copies of Kuhnhoff's manuscript. So it's really hard to say, you know, where did it originate, but the function of these prints for this particular group was to verify its existence, that the plant's existence. And literally there are hundreds of manuscripts in Japan and also some in Russia and Britain and Holland by this group. And they took thousands of these prints. And they're incredibly simple, and that's the image that you see on the cover. Oftentimes they'll just take an impression and write their name in red ink. And they will bring it back from the excursion, and my imagination is that they would contrast it to what they, you know, illustrations they have of the same plant in different document, or talk about it. And it was a portable media as well, and I think that was also a reason why this became a popular medium among this particular group.
Now, you mentioned in your description of the importance of this particular medium, and again, just as a footnote, there's also an extended discussion of copper etching as a medium. We don't really have time to talk too much about that, but I'll just gesture at that for listeners. It's also a really important medium, and it's a really interesting part of this chapter. But going back to ink rubbing, so coming out of the footnote and going back to our main discourse, one of the points that you make in your discussion here, which is really interesting, is that this was a means of preserving not just the image of an object, but as a way of preserving a particular occasion. So yeah. It was a way to prove that there was a witnessing of an object by an observer. And I think you used the phrase, it was a means to pictorialize one's encounter with an object. And so the actual topic or the actual object of the rubbing is just as much the encounter as it is the object, the material object itself. Does this have anything to do with the reason why this particular group may have used this medium more than others, or do you think there's any connection there between that?
Yeah, I definitely think, yeah, that's in some of the examples that I've seen would write, you know, in addition to the print and their name, oftentimes they reframe it. I think there's an example in the book of a hanging scroll. So they would take the print and they would frame it as a hanging scroll and write who was there when ink rubbing was made. So it becomes like a, what is that called? When you take it to a shop, like some important document, you have to have someone to
notarize it.
Yeah, sort of like a notarized document. So the name of the person who was there and the occasion, the date, you know, and sometimes they would go back to the same punch bowl and write additional information that they discovered later, and they would date that as well. So it's just, and kind of this temporal element to it, definitely, in addition to epistemological element. And to me, that's one, perhaps, overarching connection between these and photographic images. It's always about this time, particular time and meaning.
Nice segue. That brings us really nicely into the fifth chapter. Yes, well done. Well done. So the fifth chapter, and this is the final chapter of the book, looks at the use of photography. So we started out at the beginning of this project with you, you know, thinking that you were looking into the history of photography, and we're ending the book, finally getting to this point at which photography emerges as a central medium in the discourse of the field, in this discourse of Sheshet, that you've really beautifully taken us through for the rest of the story. So chapter 5 looks at the use of photography by this group in the late part of the 19th century, and it changes our focus from the local context we were in before to Edo as a context. And in this period in which Edo is being transformed and renamed in the midst of the Meiji Restoration in the 1860s. So the focus of this chapter is the way that this group's discourse about Shashin, this transposition of the real, becomes linked with this new technology in interesting and, in part, in surprising ways. There are three central figures who emerge as the major interlocutors in this chapter, and I'm just going to mention and ask you to talk a little bit about a couple of them, because there are a couple of them that represent really transformative moments in the way that this technology and way of thinking about a medium comes together with ideas of the real in different ways. So one of these members is Ito Keisuke, and we've talked, I think, a little bit about him before. At this point in the story, he's already met this doctor earlier that started out this story, right? This doctor that we talked about very beginning, von Siebold, who's a German physician working in Japan. He meets him again later on in the story. We'll talk about that in a moment. He meets him again in Edo after he's summoned to Edo as an employee of the Academy for Western Studies. So in this function, or in this set of functionings, Keisuke both heads a new office for the study of material goods and also works closely with the new Bureau for Pictorial Studies. And we'll see in what happens with him in this chapter the ways that he actually brings together really interestingly a concern with materiality and material goods, and a concern with the pictorial in ways that inform what's happening in terms of the epistemic transformations of this chapter. So can you talk a little bit about what's happening with him in this chapter, if you wouldn't mind, and how does his particular involvement in government bureaucracy inform some way of the way we think about the transformation of Shashi in this period?
Yeah, so Ito Keisuke has been the leader of this group in Owari for prior to coming to Edo. And by the time he comes to Edo, he stops seeing patients. He's devoted entirely to this governmental position. He's basically selected as someone who knows extremely well the Western herbal traditions, and therefore is headhunted by the Bakufu to come to the capital so he can start educate the new, because the Bakufu probably knew that something was up and that they had to prepare. But so Ito Keisuke has this incredible life journey from Nagoya, being ahead of this group, but also practicing fusion, comes to Edo. He's told to do what he does, which is to study Materia Medica. And this is this chance meeting with Siebold. And after he comes to Edo, Keisuke is partially trying to accommodate the needs put forth by the government, but also realizing that he can't just continue to do what he did in Owari. So getting engaged with pictorial, the Office of Pictorial pictorial
Bureau for Pictorial Studies.
Studies.
That's what I'm here for.
Getting involved with that office, I think it's his realization, okay, I have to do something new and something different. And so he takes pictorial representations much more seriously in Edo. That second meeting with Siebold, when I learned about it, I knew this is how my book is going to end. Because it was just almost too amazing that they would meet again and there would be photographic representations involved. So,
And this is really interesting also, just in terms of the way we understand visuality in this period, because in addition to talking about the ways that Keisuke is actually incorporating a concern with value to the state in his assessment of material goods, which is new in this period, in the context of his meeting with Siebold, portraiture and the connection between photography, portraiture, and materia medica emerges as something that's a really interesting part of the story.
Yeah, exactly. This is when the term shishin becomes so poignant, because it makes sense for Keisuke and people who worked with him within the group in Owari. It makes sense for them to call photographic representation portrait as shashin, right? Because there's a name, there's a person, they know this person exists, it's about an encounter. And that I think is an aspect of understanding photography or history of photography in Japan that hasn't been really addressed before. That it wasn't about only westernizing or only about making realistic images, but it was about that there were concerns about matching these three things, the existence and the name and the encounter.
And this actually, this is a perfect way to segue into the last question, actually, that I'll ask you before we conclude, which is a way to push this then into the kind of crescendo of the book, which is where this way of negotiating between portraiture, shashin, materia medica, photography kind of comes to a head in the work of Yanagawa Shunsan, who's another member of this group who's doing exactly what you just described and kind of triangulating among the West, China, Japan, and these very different contexts that all come together in his work, specifically translating a piece on photographic technology.
Yeah.
So do you want to maybe sort of use him or use any part of this last part of the book to put a kind of to talk a little bit about how shashin finally becomes associated unambiguously with photography? And we see this at the very end of the book, finally.
Yeah. So Yanagawa Shunsan was a very talented polyglot innovator. He was interested in photography, but in many other aspects of quote-unquote Western discourses, such as a newspaper. And he takes an interest in photography because he sees in it an ability to shorten distance between where he is and what is out there. It could be places in Europe, places in China, but he sees it as a way to shorten that distance. And he incorporates what he knew about this term shashin to call photography that. And that's probably as right as
great. No, that's out. And I think it's perfect that it's at the end of the book that we see the coming together of this equivalence, shashin and photography, rather than assuming that these are equivalent from the very beginning. And so I think it really nicely brings us to a conclusion of the book and also to a conclusion almost of our conversation. So, Maki, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. There's, of course, a bunch of stuff that we didn't get a chance to talk about in the book. It's a very rich book, and that's not a problem because listeners should go read the book. And as you have mentioned, pay special attention to the footnotes. Is there anything, though, in particular about the book that you'd like to mention that falls under the category of things that we didn't actually have a chance to talk about, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book.
Yeah, I'm still questioning a lot about where this book fits, and I think that's probably why I wrote it, because I don't know where it fits, in a sense of disciplinary belonging. There are ways that I mentioned how I revised it from a historical dissertation to something that could reach to a greater number of audience. But I do think that there are ways in which it could contribute to history of science or history of translation. And I guess I'm kind of putting this out there because I want to hear how, after these decades and decades of hearing about interdisciplinarity, that's always in the back here. How interdisciplinary can one get, and do we do it for the sake of that? Or is there a way in which we can actually produce meaningful work that relies upon these interdisciplinary methods? So that's one, question mark or aspects of the book that I would like to hear from people who read the book, how successful it was or how it could relate to other fields.
I mean, I think this is something that speaks a lot just in terms of the general issue to something that we talked very briefly about in the course of our conversation in terms of the content and approach that you took in narrating the book itself, but I think that is very important to the work that the book does, and that is an effort to replace a discourse of dichotomies with a discourse of triangulation. So rather than a story that's about this or that, it becomes a story that's about movement among fields, and I think that what you're doing here is one way of thinking about this transition from a this or that, this is either this field or that field, to a way of understanding transdisciplinary discourse as embodied by your book, as a movement among fields without necessarily feeling like you need to absorb the dichotomy and comfortably identify it with one or the other. And perhaps it's even more effective as understood, as a process of triangulation.
I that was my goal, but I'm just not certain how successful that
is. Well, I think it's successful. It's just the word of one reader, so at least one reader feels like it worked. So, Maki, now that this book is out, and congratulations, as you know, I think it's a great book. What's next for you? What project or projects are currently inspiring you?
So, one book length project that I'm working on is very unsurprisingly about portraits. And this is following decades where I left this book. So I'm looking at early Meiji years of portrait production in photographs and woodblocks, in oil paintings, etc. But I'm thinking about portrait as a category that was being negotiated around that same time. In other words, nobody knew what to do with portraits, how to act, interact with portraits. So the 1870s and 80s were, I feel like there were very dynamic conversations about what does it mean to look at a portrait, what does it mean to hang a portrait, and how do we relate to this person who's represented. That's my one big project. There are a few smaller projects, but it's more about, they're more methodological inquiries. So the categories that we use in our history as a given, I'm questioning those. And I guess portrait is one of the categories. Periodization is another thing that I'm working on.
So that's we can have another conversation, hopefully, about periodization, because I think a number of us are it sounds like simultaneously getting interested in questioning notions of periodization in a way that I think would make for a really interesting dialogue.
Yeah.
So stay tuned for that. We'll talk about that another time. Thank you so much, Maki. It's really been a pleasure to talk with you, and it was a pleasure to read the book.
Oh, thank you very much.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.